And gentlemen, I suppose I guess I have to introduce myself to some of you. Most of you know me quite well, I guess, for better or for worse. Now, I was asked here to give a resume of the history, both of Fairbanks and this university campus that you have now. I won't say the building, but the campus. Well, of course, the whole thing started with the discovery of gold in this camp, as you know, and naturally the first intimation that we got that there was gold discovered here was in 1902, when WADA was sent up by Mr. Barnett to spread the news, because I guess Mr. Barnett was running a trading post here at the time and he wanted to see this section develop. Well, those of us that were in Dawson at the time, naturally, we all got busy. He came up here in the spring of 1902, if I remember right. Well, and of course, we made ready to go to the Stampede. That was our purpose, was to hunt for gold, naturally, at that time. And we didn't like Canada too well anyhow. We wanted to go back to the States. Now, at that time, I wasn't even a citizen because I was underage yet at the time. But anyway, so people come down here, and the first thing, naturally, the most essential thing was to establish a recording office, because that meant a very important thing, because if you stake the claim and you didn't have it recorded, the other fellow could jump it, and then you had a lawsuit on your hands. So Mr. Wickersham, he was judge, usually appointed judge at the time, and his headquarters was in Eagle. So he came down here, and he wanted to establish a recording office and a courthouse as well. And of course, the proper place would have been at that time, would have been right at the mouth of the slough, called the Cheatham Slough. And the people that came here right away, as soon as they heard of this gold strike, they located in Cheatham and erected a town there. And when Mr. Wickersham came down, he came to Cheatham first, and he asked them if they would donate enough land to build a government building for a recording office and a courthouse, and they just flatly refused it. They said if the government wants land, they have to pay for it. Well, he told them the government doesn't pay for land, and therefore he'd have to seek some other place. So then he came up right here, where Mr. Barnett had established a trading post here, and he asked him if he would donate land for a courthouse and a recording office, that he would establish one here. And so Barnett never hesitated. He told Judge Wickersham to take anything he wanted, and that's the place he staked, is where the courthouse is right now. And that established a recording office here, and of course the miners that staked claims, they could come and record it so nobody else could jump it, though there was quite a little jumping too at the time, but nevertheless it wasn't as bad as Nome was, where he had to go down there and straighten it out. I suppose you read the spoilers, so I guess you know the whole history of it. I didn't tell you that at night. Well, that's how Fairbanks was born. And of course, those of us that came down there, we naturally chose to erect the town where the recording office was supposed to be. And from then on, of course, we started in and built up Fairbanks as much as we could at that time. It wasn't a very fancy place, because all we had was just little log cabins or tents. And as soon as the sawmills came in Woke, well, we started in and we built the town. That's how Fairbanks started. Well, those that came in with families, naturally, the educational end of it came in involved. So we had to have a schoolhouse. So the first schoolhouse that was erected here was right at the corner of Lacey and 2nd Avenue. And the building is burning down now, and it's right opposite where the Noble Motors was. That was the first schoolhouse. And soon as the people started to come in more numbers, the school was getting smaller. So then we naturally started in, and we built a bigger schoolhouse right where the present schoolhouse is there now, although it was a wooden building. And when the years went on, we needed a high school. And then Mr. Wickersham, he served 2 terms as judge here, and then he resigned. And when he resigned, he naturally was right away asked if he would serve as delegate, and which he accepted it, and then of course the political end of it started in. First thing you know, we were hard pressed for transportation here, and the only time we could get our goods in was by the river, and that would be just about 4 months in the year till it froze up again. And so therefore we asked the judge on his first term whether he could see whether we could get a mode of transportation that would alleviate a little bit the hardships of having to carry on here 8 months without even bringing in anything to eat, let alone any goods. So he promised to get us a railroad. Well, then the usual cry came up from the opposition that he'll never get it, and so forth and so on. But when he went to Congress as a delegate with no vote, and they tell me that the speech that he made there, which it was only granted to him for 15 minutes, he spoke in 2 hours. And they say it's really a masterpiece in the congressional records right now, but he got the railroad. And that was the greatest celebration at that time that I seen in the town of Fairbanks. At that time, that was in 1910. Well, of course, then in 14, by the time the commission came down here and to investigate it and so forth and so on, then the First World War broke out. That was in 13. And the railroad was dragging along at the time, but anyway, it wasn't completed in 1920, and President Harding was here, and he drove the Golden Spike. So, of course, that helped this community a great deal, because we could ship goods in at the time, and then we went along a pace. And then the third term that he ran for office, of course it was, we wanted to get a place for a higher education, because the children were growing up and it wasn't so very handy to send them outside to any places for a higher education. So we asked him if he could get us a college. Well, the opposition came down there. A college for what? Who's going to go there? And so forth and so on. But he didn't say anything. He says, if I am elected, he says, I'll get you a college. And of course, he was smart enough. When he went to Washington, and he knew he couldn't get an institution for higher education for a handful of people that was here. So he asked for the land-grant colleges that was in every state in the Union, and he so the which they couldn't refuse, and he included in the bill School of Mines. He didn't ask for a college, but he just asked for a School of Mines, which is God. And this was the origin of this institution that you're enjoying right here now. Well, I needn't tell you that the start was just like Harvard. We had five students. I'm very proud to see one sitting right there. He's the first one we had. That was Ed Loftus and his two brothers. And another one we had that had already two semesters at an institution outside. His name was Shanley. And he was our first graduate here. And of course, the Loftus boys, they had to play with the whole term of 4 years to finally they graduate. And that's the way we worked it along until what you've got right now, and I'm sure it's still going to grow more and more. Now that is the history of the growth of Fairbanks and the college as well. And I am sure that before I pass off that we'll have more buildings here with a greater number of students than what you have already. The only institution that hasn't grown, to my estimation, is our let's see. No, you're not funny. I can't think of the name, but anyway, Mr. Skagman is the professor, doctor, I would say now. He's the head of it, and that is our exhibition room, which we have more historical things to present to it, but if they had more room, and when they get more room, we'll have a whole lot more things to show you folks that was invented here in the early days, and which you'll be very glad to see. And he tells me that in another year or so, that will be expanded, so I hope to live that long, see that is expanded, and I've got several things to put in there which is worthwhile and to donate, and I'm keeping it for it. And I hope, I guess, that'll be fulfilled too before I get off. But I am one of two of the last regions the first regents that opened this institution that's still alive, and that's Mr. Snodgrass and myself. He's the one that developed Matanuska, which is, I was there this fall for the fair that they're holding, and I was very glad to see, by gosh, there were 5,000 farmers living straight on the land. And all enjoying it and living happy and everything else. Here, we've got just as good a valley as they have, and maybe better for agricultural purposes and cattle, which we hope someday by York to develop it as well. And to demonstrate is this, that when Mr. Snodgrass was in the agricultural department here, he organized the Farmers Association, and he also got the Alaska Road Commission to put a road through the loop here, you see, which you have now. And he asked them that they take up some of that wheat that his predecessor, Mr. Neal, developed here in this section. It's a Siberian wheat. It matures here in 90 days, and they're sure of a crop. So the farmers then, with his assistance and demonstrations, they grew 200 tons that year, and then the merchants subscribed for a mill, and it made the finest flour you ever tasted, and the bread that was baked from it. And it seems to mismanagement, disagreements, and whatever it developed, we lost the mill, and we lost it pretty near the seed that we had to develop. That same man, Mr. Neal, he also developed a turnip called the Petrusky turnip, which it was really the finest turnip you ever eat. And I don't know whether that's lost or not, I couldn't say, but everybody was crazy about it anyway while it lasted. And now I have built up my building here, naturally I've got to see to develop something that will keep this town going, so I'm trying to revive that very same week that we had it before. And I'm happy to say that this year we had a very fine crop of it, and we harvested. And we hope by the time we'll get enough so as to demonstrate to the new farmers that are here that we may have a mill again, and mill our own flour. Well, that's as far as I can tell you about the history of the development of this camp since it's in existence.
Mr. Bloom, the tape is just about through here. Would you stop and let us turn it over?
Sure. Right. I know.
There, you're on the air again.
Well, if you, ladies and gentlemen, if I have omitted anything that you want to find out, well, I'll be very glad to answer it to the best of my capacity.
The Tanawha Valley Railroad, when did that start, and who started it? Was it a private organization?
Oh no, the Tanawha Valley Railroad. Oh, the Tanawha Valley Railroad started from a private party. His name was Falcon Jocelyn. He was the president of it. That's that narrow gauge you're alluding to. Yeah, well, that started in 1910. It was some of the stock that the White Pass was finished with it, that he got it. Now, that little engine that you see here, that was the original one that built the White Pass in Yukon. That's from Skagway to Whitehorse. But Falcon Jocelyn is the man that built that up to Fairbanks first, you see, for to haul the freight up from China to Fairbanks in the fall of the year when the water was low in the river, and then they extended it up to Olmes, for that was for to take it out to the creeks at that time. And that was taken over by the government railroad when they built the wide gauge line.
Mr. Bloom, what were some of the arguments used against the establishment of the Alaska Agricultural College and School of Mines? Some of the opponents of the school.
Oh, in the first place, they objected to this place here, to say that no student could get out here, which to a certain extent was really true too, because it was pretty hard those 4 miles to come through that swamp before the road was built here, but then they could walk on that railroad, so they weren't so badly off. But they wanted it to the town of Fairbanks, right there on the flat, which there was no place for it. And Wickersham, I guess he could see a little further than the rest, so he purposely chose this place here in the first place. It's on the college ground. That's the land that's appropriated to the educational end of it. And then it's a nice campus because you can see the whole valley all around you. And in fact, you can see Mount McKinley at times when it's a little clear. So I think his choice was really about the most correct than anybody. But he had an awful lot of opposition, there's no question about it, just because they thought it should be in town.
that was the local people thought that, but about the rest of Alaska.
Oh, well, you know, the city of Fairbanks at that time didn't countenance anything but Fairbanks. The fact is, the panhandle wasn't considered Alaska, you know.
What did the Bonnefield Trail have to do with Fairbanks? How was that connected?
Well, the Bonnefield Trail was a trail that led out to the sheep hill there on the Little Delta there for hunting purposes more than anything. And there was some mining there on Gold King. They took out some gold from there too, you see. So that was a road that they went, that they took their necessities out in the wintertime there. It was just called after Sam Bonnefield, the man that started the First National Bank here. But that's all the Bonnefield Trail amounted to. The other one went, that's for the highway that went up to Tananaw by way of Richardson and up to Big Delta, and that's the way we had a winter road to go out to water to Valdez.
You mentioned that before the railroad came in, you had 4 months in which to get goods for the other 8 months. What kind of hardships did you experience?
Oh, mighty hard ones. No, I made two trips. In fact, you see, we used to go out to Valdez and then catch the boat and go to Seattle. And then buy our goods, whatever we want to bring in, such as perishables particularly, because as soon as the last boat came in and all the fresh fruit or anything, or eggs or anything like that, that was consumed, there was nothing more to get until next July. So we'd go out and see if we couldn't bring in some, and over that route, you see, from Valdez. Well, sometimes if we had luck, we'd make $1,000. And if we got into a storm on the Big Delta, which, you know, it's not a very pleasant river to go over there, over that Summers Lake and all that country, but you see, took advantage of the trail that the government built, you see, for the telegraph stations that, you see, at that time it was before this wireless come in, you know. The wireless didn't come in until 1906, but the government had a trail from Valdez since 1998, and they used to have stations right along, you see, but they only went as far as Kulkana, and from there they turned off to cross the Tananaw and go up to Eagle, you see, which at that time there was soldiers in Eagle and in Circle, because there was a controversy between Canada or British Columbia and the United States over the boundary line. And so the government used to take in their freight every winter, you see, with horses and double engine sleighs. I suppose you've seen some of them. But they used to only go as far as Kulkana, and we had to cross over from Kulkana over Paxton Lake and Summit Lake and then go down the Delta, which it wasn't very pleasant. And that's the way we brought in our perishables, you see. And if we didn't... Eh?
By sled,
you know, double enders, you see, those narrow sleighs. If we had good luck, why, and didn't lose a horse, didn't freeze the stuff, why, we made a little money. If it did, why, we come out on the red on it. But it was pretty tough, all right.
Mr. Bloom, how many pounds could you carry on a double ender?
Well, we generally used to load up about a half a ton to a horse. You see, the horses we brought in were the very best stock that the United States produced, because they had to haul wood here at that time, you know. That's all the fuel we had here was birchwood.
Well,
And if it didn't get into a storm, they were all right. But I tell you, when over one night sometimes there at, what do you call that pass, Isabel Pass, to be 25 feet of snow in one night. Tequila was just about worse, and all that summit to go over from Valdez to it, I'll tell you, she was some job all right. Well, I made two trips over it. One trip, I lost $2,500 apiece, besides the hardship and everything else. And, but that's what we had to do before we got the railroad.
Do you remember the horse racing they had in Fox Gulch?
In where?
Fox Gulch.
Horse racing, no, the only horse racing there was right on First Avenue. Every 4th of July. Fox Gulch, they couldn't race any horses there, they didn't have any road.
No place to race.
No, no, but in 4th of July they used to have a horse race here on First Avenue. Then, when we built what you call Wicks Field now, why, we used to make our celebration right out there when the town got larger. And that's what, and of course that's the time the airplanes come in, so the horses were discarded entirely.
Were these horses race horses, or were they just plain work horses?
Well, the best thing we had.
Over eight selling for a dozen, then you're hauling them in.
Eh?
What did eggs sell for a dozen?
Well, they used to, if you brought them in, they used to sell them from $1 to $1.50 a dozen. And that wasn't making any money on it either. Oranges, they used to sell for 2 bits apiece. Lemon, so forth, but you couldn't, we never made any money on the produce that we brought in. The only money we made, if we didn't lose any stock, why, we could get a better price here for horses than we bought them for in Seattle. That was really our main point.
What was the population of Fairbanks from 1902?
In
1902?
Two?
Yeah.
About three, I guess. Barnett and his wife and water.
How many years did it take to grow to somewhere around 5,000?
Well, in 1904 and 1905, well, in 1905, I guess we had 5,000 population.
Mr. Bloom, how did you happen to come into Alaska in the beginning, and what was your route to travel?
You mean the route to Fairbanks?
Did you come in by Canada?
Oh, I came in from Valdez here to Fairbanks. Yeah, in the spring, you see, I walked over the trail. Oh, I know that trail pretty well. I made about six trips, so it's all right.
What produce or what goods were in the greatest demand at that time that you were hauling?
Well, just perishable. Eggs. And whatever shortage is, probably bacon and ham, or any shortage that we figured that we could get our money out of, and such as oranges, lemons, or something, but not very heavy stuff, I mean, that we didn't bring in. But that was our main purpose, was to bring in the horses so as we could resell them, because horses were a very big demand here at that time, because they had to do all the hauling by horses, you see, there was nothing else here. And they used to have to haul heavy loads too, because that birch would weigh it. So we had 1,600 to 1,800 pound horses to buy
did
them.
Did you raise grain for them, or did you feed them hay on
them? No, the most of the feed was imported from the outside, you see. They used to ship in as high as about 2,000 ton of hay a season and about 1,000 ton of oats. And that was hauled in the summertime.
By boat?
By boat. The Julia B. used to haul in most of it, and she was a noted ship here, and DNC.
What was your, around 1905, what was your amusement you had in Fairbanks to get yourself from?
Oh, we had everything that you had in the United States. We had baseball in the summer, and we had basketball in the winter. And we had plenty of amusements and dancing, I suppose, and everything else. Oh, we were half civilized all the time.
Mr. Bloom, you were on the first board of regents.
Yeah.
And helped choose the first president of the university. Could you tell us about how many applications you had and how you happened to choose President Bunnell for that position?
Well, that's a history that I don't like to go into right now, you see. There was a controversy. But anyway, I'll say this for Dr. Bunnell. He wasn't a doctor then anyway, but then that he tried to do the best he knew how. But still and all, I didn't agree with his method because he... Somehow or another, he never could keep men that should have been kept here. He had some awful fine men. Now, you take such like Dr. Bastwich and Wilcox, finest man there was, and Paddy, Pilgrim. But it didn't seem to agree somehow or another. They'd stay a couple of years. And Tuesdale, there was another good man. And that's the objection that Roy had. He was too... Martinetti, shall we say.
Well, I was thinking in the beginning when you were having applications.
When the college bill passed and the first regents that were appointed, they just started in and they had no way of knowing what they was to do or anything, so they spent their money and they left the building up in the air. They didn't accomplish anything. All they did was just spent the money on the building. That was Mr. Heilig, Mr. Hess, Tony Nordale, Rickert. So they, Heilig and Hess, they resigned in McIntosh. So then there was, and then Snodgrass too. So then we were appointed, Robert Lavery and myself, and we chose Mr. Stevens.
Morton E. Stevens.
He was the president of the board at the time. Well, we didn't agree, you know. We really wanted to have an educator. Well, Judge Bunnell, he was appointed as judge, and some of the best lawyers told us that they didn't know. No, I don't know. And here, this was only a slough, and the first time that I went up there, well, you couldn't pull a polling boat by the nose with half a ton in it until the boat started and they sluiced the channel out of it, you know, those big paddle boats, you see. So that is, but you see, when he couldn't get a recording office there, he had to go somewhere else.
I have a question to ask, but so I continue the gentleman's question there. Might I ask, how did you convince your wife to come to this primitive place from Ireland?
Well, evidently she had the same lust as I had. She wanted to see for herself what the world looks like. I didn't have any trouble to ask her to come. She came herself.
Who paid for the bridges, the Cushman Street Bridge? Who paid for the Cushman Street Bridge every time it went out? And wasn't it kind of expensive?
Oh, the Cushman Street Bridge?
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, when we used to build a wooden one, naturally the float that would come down in the spring would take it out, and taxpayers paid for it.
That was kind of rough back then, huh?
Well, you know, it was a rough life all the way through, so what's the difference, more or less? We had a bridge, just the same.
Bob, may I ask you a question?
Sure.
What can you tell us about the early days when they packed, they had the horse trail from here to Anchorage, up over the Bonnefield and down following the Nenana River and past Curry, Summit and Curry, into Anchorage? There used to be a horse trail, which I walked over one time, and I've never had anybody tell me that story.
All right, now, you're asking a question now that I... you see, Anchorage was built by Mr. Mears, you see,
Captain Mears.
Well, now, there was no connection between Fairbanks and Anchorage until the railroad was halfway completed from either end, you see, so there was a narrow gap left. Well, that might have been the trail that you were talking
about.
Yeah,
it was a horse trail where they packed from one portion of the railroad to the other during construction, too.
Well, yes. Well, naturally, any time they built a piece of road, they had enough space for a road for a pack trail to go through. But there was never any true pack trail that came from Fairbanks to Anchor.
The trail I speak of was on the railroad maps that we had in the outfit cars when I worked on the railroad. It showed the horse trail on this map. And Curry was called Dead Horse at that time. In fact, it was named Dead Horse.
Yeah, but then you were on the other side of the pass yet.
But the trail came in by Healy. It crossed the Healy River up by Healy Mine.
That might have come on an account of the canyon, you see. But a pack trail could go any place for that matter, you know. If ever they had any freight to haul, that's the only way. That's the only way we started to go out from Fairbanks to the creeks is by packing the stuff over. It used to cost 25 cents a pound too, by God, to bring freight over from Fairbanks to.
I thought maybe you knew. They used to tell me about loading the horses like they load the burros down in Arizona, and pack the stuff.
Oh, listen, the pack trains that they had here was up to date pack trains. Each mule or horse had to carry at least from 350 to 400 pounds. Well, they had apparatus, you see, where they could pack with, you see.
They had regular pack equipment.
Oh, you bet, the best kind.
Well, that's what I referred to, this trail that I was told about, and I looked up.
Well, they could have went by way of Shoshitna, you know.
Yeah, they went across the mountain.
Well, yes, I know that. Well, they could. They didn't stop for any trail. They did have a trail from Valdez to Shoshitna, which they could have went over, you see, by that white horse loop that they had there.
Just prior to the promotion of the railroad, there was a pack trail.
Well, let me tell you, you may be right at that. You see, when the railroad bill was passed, there were several companies started out, you see, to build a little way so they could connect up to where they thought the railroad should be, like Valdez started and Seward started. Well, the Knickerbocker Thrift Company, they advanced quite a lot of money, and they wanted to make Seward the port instead of Valdez, you see, so they would have that. So they built a chunk of railroad of about 100 miles, I think it was. And that was the trail that they started to pack, you see, with the supplies for to build that road. And when the government, Mr. Mears was appointed the chairman, and they wouldn't let the bill go through. There was quite a hitch until, by Jove, that the government took over that piece of road that they erected it. Well, so it wasn't really the road that it should have been put in first, because we wanted to connect the railroad to the Copper River Railroad.
That was right.
To Cordova, you see, to Chitna. Well, I guess politics was different, you know, and the government bought that road. And that's how Anchorage was established, and they had that loop there, you remember, that used to go around, they called the White Horse.
That's right.
And it wasn't until, so it wasn't really a suitable road, but that's what we got anyway.
We had a survey here by Mr. Berryhill and some other Army engineers during this Second World War from the near ferry across the mountains and over into Simler to the old trail.
Well, that would be the trail, you see, that piece of ore that the Knickerbocker Trust Company sold to the
government. Well, that's the one
government.
I referred to. I'd heard that story.
Well, I guess that's about it.
Are there other questions that Mr. Boone might answer?
Was there, when the around the time of the miners going over the Bonnefield Trail, was there any development, farming development or anything on the Bonnefield Trail or across the town hall?
No, there wasn't any farming development across the Bonnefield Trail, to my knowledge. Mostly the farming was done was on this side, right on Birch Hill. And that constituted the farming center from that time. But the Bonnefield Trail was just put in there for a winter trail for to carry supplies to Gold Creek. I think Gustafson Brothers, they had, there was quite a few mines around there, and there was some pay on the other side of the divide going down towards the Tananaw by Little Delta. There's some gold taken out. There was quite a little gold came out of that country, and there was a lot of sheep came out of that country too, by Jove. That time you could kill as many as you wanted. There was no game laws or anything else, so that's where they used to haul their meat supply for Fairbanks.
Have you been over the Bonnefield Trail?
Once.
Did you see any, or did you think there was any good farming land there?
Well, there would be. There would be a lot of farming land left there because, you see, the Tanana Valley really they extends about 80 miles. The most of it is on the other side of the Tananaw. And this side of the Tananaw, there isn't so very much, but the whole of it is across the Tananaw. There's lots of valley there that's fit for agriculture, there's no question about it. And there's lots of valley that's up the Delta that may say up to the Copper River that would be good agricultural country, too. This really is the agricultural valley of the Tanana Valley is mostly agriculture more than any other valley. But most of the agricultural land is on this side of the Yukon.
How many years do you think it would take a person to settle on the other side of Tanana?
Eh?
How many years do you think it would take another person to settle on the other side of the Tanana?
Well, that depends how fast they like to get out there.
I've been here only 9 years, and I've been waiting ever since I came here for someone to settle on the other side of the Tanana.
Well, all you have to do is take a boat and cross the Tanana from then on, you're on dry land, or else if you want to go up by the Richardson Highway, take a map and you can see the country. You're going to college, aren't you?
Are there any questions about the early days, historically important, that you want to ask?
I'd like to ask Bob about Chitna and Valdez and Fairbanks. Now, we read every day these very interesting articles from Wickersham's diary.
Yeah.
And other articles. There was a lot of travel between Fairbanks and Chitna.
Sure.
Was there any opposition between Chitna and Valdez?
No, there was no opposition. You see, Valdez was the original port that Swatka, he was an army officer that was sent out after Seward got this iceberg to find out what we had there. And he made a trip, you see, from Sitka, and through Valdez, crossed over to the Yukon, and he went as far as St. Michael. So you see, he mapped out originally the country from Valdez to cross over to the Yukon. I presume he had some Indians with him to show him too. But Swatka was the first officer that the army sent out there. And also to find out a trail to the border, to the Canadian border, as far as Eagle. Well, when he came there, because the Russians, they really didn't have a specially prepared map, you know. They had it from this star or some other thing, you know, to this one and so forth. So he found out, you see, that the Hudson Bay Company had already come in and settled themselves in Rampart. And when he reported it, that's when the United States sent in troops here, you see, and they explored the country and remapped it, but then that was the dispute, you see, that the British Columbia government with the Canadians, that they thought they ought to take the whole territory. So they settled then on the 40-mile line, that's on the Eagle summit, but there was still territory between here, you see, and 40 mile. And that was settled in 1915 when Taft was chosen as the moderator. And I think Riggs and Ogilvie, these two surveyors, they finally went and blazed out that line that you see on the boundary, that white line, you see. And of course Riggs, he was governor here at the time too. And but Chitna was the head of the Copper River Railroad until they extended it to the mine, to the Kennecott mine there. So, but for us, it was quite an advantage, you see, because when we wanted to go out in the winter time, we avoided that summit, you see, because that was a bad one, you know, to go over that 100 miles extra. So we used to go to Chitna and then get the train there and go to Cordova, and of course we got a boat in Cordova. So that's the way Chitna was born and existed. I remember I was on the first train that ran through, a freight train from Chitna to Cordova.
What year was that?
That was in 1911. If I remember right, yes, I think it was in 11. And of course, as soon as the Copper River was discontinued, my Chitna became the ghost town.
Well, there was double ender service to Valdez.
But Valdez was always.
From 1911.
Yeah, but until 1911. Then it was discontinued. Even the stage didn't go there anymore in the winter time, because that summit was closed anyway, you know, and to go through that snow there on Thompson's Pass and Beaver Dam, and it was a dam anyway. So, you see, that's why Chitna was created. And then they extended the Copper River, they extended to Kennecott, where they used to haul the ore out. Until they found ore in Africa that could be mined for about one-third what it cost here, so they abandoned the Kennecott. But there's still good copper there in the Kennecott country. And of course, Cordova, she was a thriving town at the time that they, all the steamboats used to come in there, haul that copper stuff, haul the freight out again. But that eliminated the Valdez summit in the winter time.
Bob, would you tell them about this first agricultural farm here, this first produce award that was made in this valley you told me about?
Well, I tell you, I've got a cup that was given in St. Paul for the best vegetable that was grown in this valley in 1911.
Shipped out from here?
Yes, shipped out. You see, Falcon Jocelyn, the man that I told you that built the little town on our railroad, he was here at the time they had a kind of a little fair, not a little one, they had a fair here, and there were several things that was worth demonstrating. Now, for instance, your strawberry that you got here that you enjoy so much. It took 6 years to develop that strawberry by a man by the name of John Charlie. He was a Swiss. He had his garden right there where the parochial school is right now, you know, and he used to go out every winter and bring in some plants from Washington with a dog team from Valdez and transplant them with a native strawberry, one of those little ones that you see, until he developed that strawberry that could stay out all winter in 60, 70 below and come up in the spring again. That's what you enjoy right here now. So after he developed that, there was no market really for him, so he went to Winnipeg, and he made money then with that plant right there. Now that's how the strawberries was. Well, then there was 25-pound cabbages it grew that time, but for the first agriculture was really started by George Weaver. He staked where Grail is now. He brought over, he was a packer in American Creek, so when Fairbanks was struck, he came over with two little cayuses, and all he had was a plow and a harrow and two sacks of oats. Because we didn't know if anything would grow here or anything at the time. So he staked Grail, and Johnny Eidelman, and a man by the name of Newcomb, and let's see, Newcomb, Eidelman, and Young, that's where Bentley has got his dairy and all that, that was Young's ranch, and Mel Sabin, that constituted the, and there was another one that constituted all the farming element. Well, Eidelman is right where Hamilton Acres is now. And then, of course, there's Busby, and Bentley staked the island, you see, and that was, and Barry, he was the first rancher, right? He staked right from Fairbanks out, and a fellow by the name of, and Rickert, and Bismarck. Coley was his name, but they called him Bismarck. Well, they had all their ranches, and then, of course, afterwards, people staked more up to the river, the Tanana River, but that furnished all the vegetables that Fairbanks consumed in the first winter. Then McGrath, he went up the hill further, and he grew the potatoes. He was the potato king. Oh, and then all them people that staked all the loop, later, after the wood was cut off, why, they went to farming, and that's how the farming developed right here. And I knew all of them, but somehow I forgot some of their names. But and so Weaver, he was the first one that cultivated the oats for his horses. Eidelman, he grew all the vegetables. And yes, there was Zender. He had that farm right where the FE company is now. And
O'Connor?
Well, O'Connor only had a lot right there where the bridge is right now. Well, you see, but that Bentley's ranch, Young's ranch rather, joined with Hinckley's ranch. And Hinckley, well, he had a dairy in Grail, and then when he lost that dairy, why, he staked that ranch for Charlie Kramer is right now. And that's the way they kept spreading out, you see.
Are there questions of historical importance? If not, Mr. Bloom, we do appreciate your coming here tonight, no end. I think that you have filled in a great many empty spots that we have been wanting to know about.
Well, I did the best I could from memory, you know. I guess it's quite a while.
We're very interested in these historical things that you have that are coming to the university. That certainly is a very worthwhile thing to do.
Well, I tell you, really, Fairbanks has got a history, all right. After all, there was a lot of people came in here from all sections of the world and made a community and started an educational system and a law-abiding system. We had less law-breaking in here without any mounted police than what they had in Dawson with the mounted police. So I think that's one thing, you know, that we can be proud of too. You see, as I say, you can talk on lots of things, but quite a lot of things happens in 56 years, you know.
How did you form your first police force or your first law enforcement?
Well, then we incorporated the town of Fairbanks. Naturally, when we voted in a mayor and a council, then we had to have a policeman, one policeman. Once in a while, they used to, the kids would tie him up to a tree by a gun. I guess you remember that.
Well, yes, a little bit. Well, yeah. Thank you, sir, very much. And
you're very welcome. I'm very glad to be here before you. And if there's any other time, maybe I'll think some more, and maybe you'll think some more. If I can answer it, well, I'll be very glad to.
Well, thank you very much.